From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air. Today's newspaper headlines tell of massive layoffs, but a surge in the Dow Jones average. We're in a war, but we're also in a recession. Just what is going on with the economy? On this edition of Fresh Air, we ask economist Robert Kuttner. Also, we meet actress Blair Brown. She stars in TV's The Days and Nights of Molly Dodd. And book critic John Leonard reviews The Search for the Pink-Headed Duck, Rory Nugent's adventurous quest for one of the world's rarest birds. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Corey Flintoff. There were indications tonight that Soviet envoy Yevgeny Primakov might have achieved some progress in talks with the Iraqi leadership. Baghdad Radio reported that President Saddam Hussein told Primakov that Iraq is prepared to cooperate with the Soviet Union and other nations to find a peaceful solution to the war. The report said that Primakov carried a message to Saddam from Soviet President Mikhail Gorbachev. Saddam was quoted as saying that Iraq was prepared to extend cooperation in the interest of finding a peaceful, political, equitable, and honorable solution to the region's central issues, including the situation in the Gulf. The British War Cabinet met today for the first time since a mortar attack by the Irish Republican Army last Thursday. NPR's Brian Naylor reports from London.
The bomb-resistant glass in the windows of the cabinet room was still shattered, but the meeting was held just the same, with Prime Minister John Major reportedly telling the senior ministers and military chiefs assembled, "It's good to be back." The last time the cabinet gathered 5 days ago, the meeting was interrupted when IRA guerrillas fired three mortars at No. 10 Downing Street, one landing in the garden behind the cabinet room. British government sources say that Major held a half-hour phone discussion with President Bush last evening to discuss the result of a visit by top American military officials to Saudi Arabia over the weekend. The British Defense Minister, Tom King, is in Washington to get a first-hand report from President Bush on when the ground war against Iraq might begin. This is Brian Naylor in London.
The Jordanian press announced today the execution of a military officer and a civilian on charges they spied for Israel. NPR's John Burnett reports.
Jordan's official Petra news agency reported today that a Jordanian Air Force lieutenant, Ali Abdul Hafez, and a civilian vegetable truck driver, Ahmed Mohammed Ahmed, were convicted of high treason by a military court and hanged. The executions took place 9 days ago at Swaqa Prison, 50 miles south of Amman. They were charged with passing military intelligence to Israel. A military source told Reuters news agency that the 24-year-old pilot was recruited by an Israeli woman with whom he had an affair. He was taken to Israel and trained by the Mossad intelligence service. The source said the lieutenant had no access to sensitive information. The executions were the first in nearly 30 years. The official news agency did not say whether they were connected to the Gulf War. In Amman, I'm John Burnett reporting.
Defense Department officials said today that more than 50 oil fires are burning in Kuwait. Admiral Mike McConnell said that most of the fires have been lit by Iraqi forces to help conceal their troop positions from Allied aircraft. Officials said that some of the fires may have been caused by accidental strikes from Allied bombs. On Wall Street today, the Dow Jones Industrial Average lost more than 27 points to close at 2874.75. This is NPR News. Soviet Prime Minister Valentin Pavlov has charged that Western and Soviet bankers tried to topple President Mikhail Gorbachev in an economic coup. Pavlov made the charge in an interview with a trade union newspaper. He claimed that the banks planned to flood the Soviet Union with billions of rubles, causing hyperinflation and economic chaos. Pavlov said his government defeated the bank tactic by pulling large denomination ruble notes out of circulation. The government claimed earlier that 150 ruble notes were withdrawn to stop black market trading. Pavlov claimed that Canadian, Swiss, and Austrian banks were players in what he called a financial war. Canadian bankers have denied the allegations. A new study shows that women with diabetes can dramatically reduce the risk of giving birth to children with severe malformations. NPR's Richard Harris reports that the secret lies in careful control of blood sugar even before pregnancy.
Major birth defects are common in children born to diabetic mothers, and the risk is greatest among women who have trouble controlling their blood sugar levels in the first weeks of pregnancy. A study in today's Journal of the American Medical Association shows that women can dramatically improve the outlook for their babies by taking great care to control their blood sugar level even before they know they're pregnant. Researchers at the University of California in San Francisco found that these women could reduce the risk of major birth defects to just 1%. In contrast, women who took extra care only after the sixth week of pregnancy were 10 times more likely to give birth to children with major malformations. This is Richard Harris in Washington.
The president's top economic advisor acknowledged today that the U.S. economy is in a recession, but predicted that the downturn will last only until the middle of this year. Michael Boskin said that high oil costs, an important factor in the downturn, have already been eased with the price drop that came with the start of the Persian Gulf War. I'm Corey Flintoff. This is National Public Radio News from Washington.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. World War II got us out of the Depression, but what effect will the Gulf War have on today's recession? My guest is economist Robert Kuttner. Kuttner is economics correspondent for the New Republic and a columnist for Business Week and the Boston Globe. He co-founded the liberal quarterly The American Prospect, and he served as chief investigator of the Senate Committee on Banking, Housing, and Urban Affairs. Kuttner is the author of a new book about the global economy in the post-Cold War era. It's called The End of Laissez-Faire. I spoke with him this morning and asked him how World War II helped the economy recover from the Depression.
World War II was a totally different kind of effort. The economy as a whole was mobilized for war. At one point, we were spending close to half the gross national product on the war. We also had wage and price controls. We had a surtax on high incomes. We had coerced savings, as it were, through the war bonds program. We had the Federal Reserve entering into an agreement with the executive branch to finance the debt of the government at very low interest rates. So it was as close to a command economy as the United States has ever been. And in addition, it served as an extraordinary public works program. You had close to 10 million men and women working for the military. You also had people working in defense plants. All of the slack in the economy that had accumulated during the Great Depression was mobilized for war. And the effect, the stimulus on the economy was so potent that by 1945, when the war was over, the civilian part of the economy had increased by 50%, never mind how much of it had all gone up in smoke. So this was a total mobilization. The current war is spending at the rate of, say, $100 billion a year. That's 2% of gross national product, and much of the war is an inventory war. We're shooting off the weapons that we stockpiled during the Cold War, so it has very little stimulative effect on the economy, and moreover, we don't have wage and price controls, so that the little stimulus you do get leads to some inflationary pressures that the government is not counteracting, nor is the government taking any special measures to pay for the war. So you kind of end up with the worst of both worlds. You're not getting the stimulus, and you may get some inflationary pressures.
Alan Greenspan, the chair of the Fed, says that an extended war would deepen the recession. How would it do that?
Well, it would do it in a number of respects. First of all, the war depresses consumer confidence. And the timing of this war was such that it came about just as the economy was slipping into recession anyway.
Mm-hmm.
So if people were putting off the purchase of a new car or some other consumer durable, the war led them to think three times if they were already thinking twice about making that purchase. The other thing is that if the war is prolonged, the price of oil shoots right back up. The oil prices have come down, in part because futures markets think the war is going to be over soon, in part because we've persuaded our friends to pump more oil. But oil prices are very volatile, and a prolonged war would send them skyrocketing again. Also, we have this accumulated deficit, and the war is on budget for purposes of incurring deficits, but it's off budget for purposes of Graham-Rudman. It doesn't count in the Graham-Rudman calculations. And the longer the war goes on, the more we keep piling on deficits, which were already excessive.
The headlines in today's newspapers are are baffling. On the business pages, the business page of the New York Times, you know, in the business section, there's an article on Sears and Roebuck eliminating 9,000 jobs, U.S. Air cutting back 3,585 jobs. And at the same time, the stock market is soaring. The Dow Jones average was up 71.54 yesterday. The
right.
Dow is up 15% since the war began. Can you explain?
It really is astonishing.
Yeah, can you explain why, in a time of so many layoffs, how Wall Street is soaring like that?
Well, let me explain it a few different ways. The stock market is a terrible indicator of the real economy. People invest in stocks based on their expectations of what other investors are going to do. Now, a couple of factors explain why the stock market is going up for the moment, but that should not be taken as a sign of health of the real economy. In fact, I would not be surprised if there were a fairly severe, I guess the euphemism is correction. You can't say crash anymore. What happened was this. The stock market 6 months ago was reacting to higher oil prices and to the beginning of a recession. So the stock market dropped several hundred points. Subsequently, the Federal Reserve has cut interest rates. Now, when interest rates drop, bonds become a less desirable investment and stocks become a more desirable investment. Investors then anticipate the behavior of other investors. The herd instinct takes over. People expect that money is going to pour out of bonds into stocks, and everybody wants to get in on the act. Then the price of oil drops faster than a lot of people thought, so that you have a kind of short-term bull market phenomenon in which everybody wants to get in on the action before it peaks, and that psychology pushes the market up. Meanwhile, as you suggest on the business page, the real economy is going down the drain. And the stock market going up is not in any way likely to help the real economy. The real economy is in trouble for a whole independent set of reasons. So I think the stock market boom is a short run, it's ephemeral, and it is not by any means a sign of economic health.
Robert Kuttner is my guest, and he's economic correspondent for The New Republic. He's a columnist for Business Week and the Boston Globe. And he's the author of a new book called The End of Laissez-Faire, National Purpose and the Global Economy After the Cold War. Something else that really confuses me right now, the United States is very much in debt, yet we're involved in a very expensive war. The Wall Street Journal recently estimated the cost of the war at $600 million a day, with the possibility of the cost rising as high as $2 billion a day in a ground war. Now, I know that the Allies are contributing a lot of money to the war. The United States is hardly having to foot this single-handedly. But still, the costs for the United States are quite high. Where exactly do we get the money from to pay for the war when we're as in debt as we are? Where does the money come from?
Well, we borrow more money. We borrow some of it from our own selves, our own citizens, and we borrow some of it from abroad. And it's remarkable how right-thinking people can be worried about the level of debt, the level of deficit spending, which is almost universally held to be too high, and held to be the reason why we can't spend money on things that most Americans want, everything from public infrastructure to health care to child care and the rest of the laundry list, and all of a sudden a perceived threat to the national security comes along, and all those qualms are put on the shelf because a war is something that you simply have to do if the leaders define it as a sufficiently severe threat. So we simply borrow more money.
And that means that the debt goes up higher.
Sure. I mean, the debt is nothing but the accumulated total of past borrowings, and it also means that the current deficit goes higher. And all of Congress's efforts with the president last year to strike a budget deal have already been overtaken by events. The 40 or so billion dollar savings that Congress and the president were able to agree on for this fiscal year has already been swamped by the cost of the war. The fact that it is spending for national security purposes doesn't change the economic impact of it. If the deficit was too high at $200 billion, it's that much more too high at $300 billion. And of course, since a good portion of this is borrowed from abroad, that makes it even more serious because it limits the Federal Reserve's ability to fight recession by lowering interest rates. If you are trying to coax money into the United States from Japanese investors or German investors who can put their money into their own bonds, which pay equal or higher interest rates, and which don't have the same risk of currency depreciation that a dollar investment does from the point of view of a Japanese investor or a German investor, the result is that the Federal Reserve has to put up interest rates higher than it otherwise would like to. That's the real long-term cost of all of this foreign borrowing, and that makes it harder to fight the recession. It makes it more expensive to finance the existing debt, and it makes it more expensive to pay for the costs of the war. So the war compounds the pickle that the economy is already in.
If you're just joining us, my guest is Robert Kuttner, and he's the economic correspondent for The New Republic, a columnist for Business Week and the Boston Globe, and the author of a new book called The End of Laissez-Faire. Let's take a short break, and then we'll talk some more. This is Fresh Air. Economist Robert Kuttner is my guest. He's the author of a new book called The End of Laissez-Faire, National Purpose and the Global Economy After the Cold War. Let me quote something that Senator Edward Kennedy recently said. He said, if we can spend so much money defending the throne of the Emir of Kuwait, why can't we do something to defend the jobs of American workers? Now, is the money that we're spending on the war money that we would otherwise be using at home to create new jobs or for health care or social welfare, or are the two, when it comes down to it, pretty unrelated in terms of where the money's coming from?
Well, you're really posing a political question, Terry. If senators and congressmen had stepped forward and said, the country is facing a severe domestic crisis, living standards for 80% of families have stagnated or declined, our infrastructure is a ruin, our civilian research and development investments are not keeping pace with those of our competitors. We need to spend $100 billion a year to get the country's economy in order. That would not have commanded majority support in the Congress, nor would the administration have supported it. But somehow, money can always be found to fight a war. So I don't think you could say as a political matter that if we had not fought this war, that money would have been spent on other good things. Doesn't mean it shouldn't have been spent. It means that it's very difficult politics. The other way in which spending for war constrains what we can do at home is that it eats up the peace dividend. When the Cold War ended, there was a great deal of hope that the spending that had gone for the military, based on our assumptions about the East-West conflict, could now be reduced and could now be spent for domestic needs. Obviously, this new perceived threat in the Middle East is going to mean a relatively larger military, and it's going to increase the deficit in a way that constrains the ability of Congress to spend any new money on civilian needs that it might have targeted with a peace dividend mood or a peace dividend psychology. So not only does it consume money that otherwise might have been available for domestic spending, but it creates both a psychology and a budgetary reality in which you can't even think about spending money on civilian needs.
You've looked at the budget President Bush submitted for 1992. How do you think domestic issues will fare in that budget? And I'm wondering if you see the results of the borrowing that America has to do to pay for the Gulf War, if you see the results of that in the way the 1992 budget plays out.
Well, I think it drastically constrains the ability of the president or the Congress to spend money on anything domestic. You have a kind of shell game going on where he's shifting money from one account to another account, but domestic spending is not really keeping pace with inflation. you have the debt going up, which means that interest costs go up, and that eats into the government's ability to spend money on other things. So clearly the war has a tremendous effect both on the balance sheet and on the psychology and the politics.
The savings and loan crisis added to America's financial problems. How worried are you about the commercial banks now? Do you envision a commercial bank crisis in the future?
I'm very worried about the commercial banks. I think the banks find themselves in a really unprecedented squeeze, certainly unprecedented since the Great Depression. And I don't think the administration has a clear sense of how to fix it. My worry is that they're going to try and fix it the same way they tried to fix the savings and loans 10 years ago with the same kind of result. The banks got into difficulty because in the 1970s, when you had the beginning of deregulation, you had money market mutual funds competing with banks for the saver's dollar. You had Wall Street and the so-called commercial paper market, which means the ability of corporations to borrow directly from the public, competing with the bank's traditional lending customers. As a result, banks got themselves more heavily into high-risk lending. They got more involved in third-world loans. They got more involved in junk bond deals. And they got more involved in real estate as a way of compensating for the fact that the traditional bread-and-butter business that they had enjoyed previously was drying up. And when the real estate market started getting soft, when the third-world loans turned bad, the bank's balance sheets deteriorated. That is, they found themselves with more bad loans and less earnings. And the administration somehow thinks that if you let banks become more speculative, that will make them more profitable. And, of course, this was exactly what happened with the savings and loan crisis. Savings and loans, in line with the prevailing vogue for deregulation, were allowed to become more speculative in where they put, I started to say where they put their money, where they put other people's money, and they were allowed to become more entrepreneurial in bidding for money. They were bidding against each other to see who could pay the highest interest rates. Given the fact that they were having to pay high interest rates to attract money, they then had to become more speculative in where they invested that money, and the result was the savings and loan meltdown.
I'm going to ask you to take everything that you've told us and kind of bring it down to a very practical level. Do you think that we're in for difficult economic times in the near future?
Yes, I think we're in for terrible economic times. And the reason is that the normal tools that the government has to get us out of recession are not available. We can't use very low interest rates. We can't use deficit spending. And on top of that, we have a very shaky banking sector. And I think if the war ends quickly, that will enable us to refocus on the economy that much more quickly. But it won't solve the economic problems because the fundamental problems of the economy were not caused by the war, and they won't be cured by a quick end of the war. If the war goes on for a longer time, it will only make the economic situation that much worse. And I think in addition to the fact that the real economy is in trouble, you also have a misguided set of assumptions about what to do about it. You have a continuation of the same ideology that prevailed in the early 1980s, which insisted that the only things ailing the economy were that it was too regulated, that the government loomed too large, and that the cure was to deregulate everything, privatize everything, get the government off everybody's back. Well, we saw the result of that. The result of that was a decade of deferral in which the real national debt doubled, in which the banking sector got shaky, and none of it bore the kind of fruit that was promised. And yet the same kinds of people are still making the same kinds of policies. You have a kinder, gentler version of the rhetoric under George Bush than you did under Ronald Reagan, but the same philosophy reigns.
Robert Kuttner, I want to thank you very much for speaking with us today. Thank you for your time.
Nice to be with you.
Economist Robert Kuttner, he's written a new book called The End of Laissez-Faire about the global economy in the new post-Cold War era. That will be the subject of a future interview. Since the start of the Gulf War, many people have put travel and vacations on hold. Book critic John Leonard's found a new book he says can offer a vicarious adventure experience. It's called The Search for the Pink-Headed Duck by Rory Nugent.
About all the book jacket is willing to tell us of Rory Nugent is that he sailed the Atlantic single-handed 4.5 times, looked for dinosaurs in the Congo, and wrote about Chappaquiddick for the New York Post, though he's no longer in the newspaper game. About all he'll say of himself in this nifty book is that he must have seemed weird in Calcutta, the only Westerner, he says, in the area, and because of my height, pale complexion, and baldness, I look a little like a walking floor lamp. Besides, he would appear to specialize in getting lost. Cartography, he admits, has never been my strong point. A professor of geography, reviewing some maps I had drawn of a region in Africa, concluded, "Terra incognita is safe in your hands." However, being lost is also no big deal. As long as we're traveling toward the unknown, he says, we're on the right track. And what, you may wonder, is Rory Nugent doing in Calcutta? He's looking, not for a mallard, or a pochard, or a widgeon, but for the very rare pink-headed duck, last spotted in India in 1935. You'll want to know why. Never mind. It's a quest, for which he has armed himself with a page torn from an encyclopedia, a machete and a folding saw, lots of rupees, and for protection, a splinter from the tree of Buddha in a Ziploc bag. He's also learned the blood-curdling mating call of the pink-headed duck, which sounds to the untrained ear like a yak in pain. When the guards at various Indian bureaucracies in Calcutta and Delhi see him coming, they cry out, "Quack, quack," in friendly greeting. These bureaucracies, however, refuse him the permission he needs to explore other likely habitats of the pinkhead, like the great rhododendron forest of northeastern Sikkim, or the upper Brahmaputra River Valley, near the conjunction of Burma and India, and that portion of Tibet where the Chinese dump their radioactive nuclear waste. He will go there anyway, with the help of gangsters, mystics, and the Gurkha National Liberation Front. He will hack his way through the rhododendrons and the giant teak, through stringy Persian lilacs, yellow-flowered creepers, blue fungi, and 1,000 species of orchids. He will be flapped at overhead by spotted babblers, racket-tailed drongos with cobalt-colored feathers, and the horn-eared, leaf-nosed Himalayan bat. He will hear the music of turtle-shell zithers and eat pigeon stew and water buffalo burgers. He will swim in the Brahmaputra, among Ganges dolphins with dull black skin and barracuda snouts, and even in the Ganges itself, where he'll surface elbow-deep in the spongy remains of burned and bloated human bodies. He'll stumble upon the City of Blood and the left breast of Kali. He'll risk sudden death from Chinese soldiers, Sikkimese sailors, Gurkha guerrillas, Bengali Marxists, leopards and bears and yetis, and in the Valley of Bliss, a Mi-Goo, the evil-eyed abominable snowman. Perhaps Rory Nugent's greatest trial is after midnight, with some Tantra Buddhist sex fiends, where he finds himself the wallflower at a necrophilia orgy, with a female corpse in his reluctant arms. You will want to know if he ever locates that pink-headed duck. I'm not going to tell you, and I'm not sure I believe him anyway, but I will say that America has at last produced a travel writer as crazy as the English. A splendid quack.
John Leonard is media critic for CBS Sunday Morning. He reviewed The Search for the Pink-Headed Duck by Rory Nugent. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Additional support comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced, and Apple Computer in personal computing, providing the power to be your best. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
From Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. If you don't have cable, you've missed what's happened to Molly Dodd since the series left network TV. She's had several jobs, several lovers, several hairstyles, and she's about to have a baby. Coming up, we meet the star of the days and nights of Molly Dodd, actress Blair Brown. That's coming up on Fresh Air.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Ann Taylor. According to a report on Baghdad Radio, Iraqi President Saddam Hussein has told a Soviet diplomat that Iraq is prepared to cooperate with the Soviet Union to find a peaceful solution to the Persian Gulf War. The radio report says that Soviet envoy Primakov gave the Iraqi leader a message from Soviet leader Gorbachev during talks today. The radio quoted Saddam as saying Iraq is prepared to extend cooperation to the Soviet Union and other nations and agencies in the interest of finding a peaceful, political, fair, and honorable solution to the region's central issues, including the situation in the Gulf. France's new defense minister is in Washington and said today his country is in agreement with the U.S. on the timing of future operations in the Persian Gulf. NPR's Paz Cohen has more.
Defense Minister Jacques said the decision on when to start a ground war is a mix of military and political considerations to be weighed by coalition leaders, including President Bush and French President François Mitterrand. When the time comes, Jacques told a Washington news conference, French troops in the Gulf will be among the first to fight.
As soon as the ground phase would begin, this French division would be involved in these operations. In the general plan of the operation.
Jacques' predecessor left his position as French defense minister last month because he disagreed with French support for U.S. Gulf War policy, especially the massive Allied bombing of Iraq. Today, Jacques said those airstrikes were made necessary by Saddam Hussein's stubbornness in refusing to withdraw from Kuwait. In Washington, I'm Paz Cohen.
In South Africa, the prosecutor in the Winnie Mandela trial told a judge today that two more witnesses against Mrs. Mandela were too scared to testify. NPR's John Madison reports from Johannesburg.
To begin with, there were four young men who were kidnapped, taken to Winnie Mandela's house, and according to the prosecutor, assaulted by Mrs. Mandela and members of her bodyguard. One of those kidnapped was Stompie Moketsi, who was then removed from the house and found murdered a few days later. The second was Pelo Mekgwe. He was to have been the first witness at the start of proceedings against Mrs. Mandela yesterday, but the night before he was reportedly kidnapped and the prosecutor can't find him. The third and fourth were due to appear in court today as the remaining witnesses against Mrs. Mandela. But a civil rights lawyer reported to the prosecutor today that they are in a safe place near the court, but that they're too scared to give evidence. The trial was postponed for the second time in 2 days, so the prosecutor can try to coax them into the courtroom. I'm John Madison in Johannesburg.
On Wall Street, the Dow Jones Industrials moved down over 27 points to close at 2,874.75 on volume of some 256 million shares. This is NPR News. Government officials in Germany have conceded that Bonn did not realize the full extent of the financial crisis in the eastern part of the country and have announced a series of new measures to deal with the shattered economy. The emergency aid program, if approved, will cost an extra $7 billion a year. Chancellor Kohl has also agreed with top union leaders and employers to fight high unemployment by doubling the number of jobs created by public works projects. Problems in the east have grown worse over the last few weeks, and officials say up to 3 million East Germans could lose their jobs this year if the government does not take steps. As the Warsaw Pact draws closer to breaking up, Hungary intends to end a bilateral military agreement with the Soviet Union. Judith Ingram reports from Budapest.
Hungarian Defense Minister Lajos Fer first suggested a military agreement with Soviet officials last fall. Hungary wants to replace the Moscow-centered multilateral security structure with a network of bilateral military agreements. Last fall, Hungary concluded a military agreement with Romania and signed a similar agreement with Czechoslovakia in January. These agreements, which have not been made public, are said to provide for information exchange to increase mutual confidence. According to a high-ranking defense ministry official, they rule out joint exercises. Defense Minister Föhr has said that one important component of the Hungarian-Soviet military agreement will be the Soviet Union's continued provision of military technology and spare parts to Hungary. The two sides are expected to start negotiating at a meeting of the Warsaw Pact scheduled for late February in Budapest. For National Public Radio, this is Judith Ingram in Budapest.
Iceland has become the first country to move toward establishing diplomatic relations with Lithuania. Iceland's parliament voted yesterday to adopt a resolution endorsing the government's de facto recognition of an independent Lithuanian government. In trading today in Europe, the dollar moved up. Gold prices were mixed. This is NPR News in Washington.
This is Fresh Air. Molly Dodd is having her baby next week. My guest is Blair Brown, who plays Molly in the TV series The Days and Nights of Molly Dodd. She also co-starred in the movies Altered States, One Trick Pony, and Continental Divide. Molly Dodd premiered almost 4 years ago on NBC, then moved to Lifetime Cable. This is the show's last season. Blair Brown once described it as a show for people who thought they'd end up yuppies, but didn't. The story of someone who reaches the midpoint of life and realizes a lot of her dreams aren't going to come true. Molly is close to 40 and lives alone. She's independent, but always yearns for what she doesn't have. She works, but it's always a job, never a career. And now she's about to have a baby. Molly was even going to marry the father, Detective Nate Hawthorne. But he died a couple of episodes ago in a restaurant after being accidentally served the food he was most allergic to, shrimp. Here's a scene from a recent episode before Nate's death. Molly is assembling a crib while her mother watches disapprovingly. Molly's mother is always disapproving, but it's about to get worse when she finds out that Nate Hawthorne is the father. Nate is black.
You wouldn't remember how these things work, would you?
After 40 years, I don't think so.
Well, it's a lot harder than it looks.
Well, it looks hard. It's times like these when you need a man around. Of course, the rest of the time, they're more trouble than they're worth.
Well, you may as well know there might be a man around here soon
enough. Oh, Davy is coming to help you put this together?
No. I talked to the doctor.
And?
Nate's the father.
Well, I suppose that's to be expected.
You know, you are doing a remarkable job of hiding the utter joy and excitement that you must be feeling right now.
This means that you two will be getting...
Getting married, yes.
Molly, don't you think you're being just a little unrealistic?
Blair Brown, whose idea was it for you to have a baby in the Molly Dodd series?
When we were approaching this last season, I think a lot of us felt a bit stuck with Molly, that we had to deal with the baby issue at some point. If Molly is nearing 40, the business of having a baby or not having a baby, you know, comes up is important. And I felt very strongly that she should have a child, because I thought it would be interesting to follow a single mother, assuming that Molly would inevitably not be married and would not have someone in her life, since that's kind of been the character all along, that she's a very independent sort and an odd bird in some way, and that was really our journey, was to see a more solitary character than a lot of shows have. So I know I was very pro the idea. Jay Tarsus originally was not too keen. He said, "Do you realize that once we get saddled with a child, it becomes a whole other story?" But I think what happened is that writers then took that idea and really retained the original format, which is that it's a diary of this woman's reactions to the world, so that even in the shows now that where the baby, after the baby is born, it's not so much see Molly diaper a baby, see, it's more the reaction that she has to motherhood and how the rest of her life works with having a child.
Now, Molly Dodd started off on network TV and then ended up on cable. Did you find that there were things you could do on cable that you couldn't do on network?
Well, initially, that didn't seem to be so, because to be fair to NBC, they were really not very restrictive of us while we were making the show. The trouble we had with them was really always after the fact, the mean things they'd say about us in the press. But when we were making the show, there didn't seem to be really too much interference. Every now and then Standard and Practices come in and wants to haggle about a word. But usually we were able to hold our ground. What I found actually working in cable over time was that when you know you're writing something for a network or you know, producing something for a network, your own censorship really sets in. So you tend just to curb some of your ideas, thinking, this is really going to be a hassle if we want to do this, or that you just kind of bring the parameters in of what you want to do. And all of a sudden, the doors were wide open. Plus, you don't have that business of sitting down the next morning and looking at the Nielsens and, you know, moment by moment going, well, why did we lose the numbers here and why this? The cable is a whole different ballgame. They have ratings, but they seem to be less ratings bound in what they're doing, and are really, we're genuinely more interested in the product and what we all thought and they thought was the most interesting way to tell the story.
Is there a story development that you did on cable that you think you would have self-censored had you still been on broadcast TV?
Well, the whole relationship that Molly has with Detective Hawthorne, because he's black and because she's white, would have been a thing, a deal at a network, whereas it seemed to me that we were able to this happens to be the person Molly fell in love with and who fell in love with her. And it was not a show about black and white. I think with the network, usually they have to treat it with a but kind of parenthesis around it all the time, like that's what this is about. And I thought we were able to deal with it in a much more relaxed way. It was just a story.
The character of Molly Dodd was written for you by Jay Tarsis, the creator of the series.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, he wrote the character for you. It was written around you. What are the ways that you think you're similar and different to the character that you've become so identified with?
Well, it's interesting. I mean, Molly and I are actually very different in many ways. Jay had just been asked by NBC to do a series about a modern woman living in a big city, and he wanted to work with me, and they said fine, and so he and I went and talked a lot about all the things we didn't want her to be. We didn't want her to be much of a perfect person. We really wanted her not to be ambitious. We wanted her not to be a lot of the things that particularly, say, 4 or 5 years ago, were the images of women on television, these kind of 360-degree people who are careerists and fabulous friends and sexy wives and good mothers and loyal daughters. And, you know, there's not enough time, there's not enough hours in the day to be all those things. So we made her a person who was bad-tempered sometimes, or sometimes very close-minded, sometimes, you know, open-minded to a fault. We wanted to create a person who was a little more eccentric and in that way a lot more like real people. The parallels between me and Molly, I think what I discovered in doing it is that in a drama, you can actually be quite far away from yourself. You can, you know, gain weight, lose weight, accents, new hairdos, all these prosthetics, things like that. But oddly, when you're doing comedy, it's very close to your sensibility because I don't know how you act anything that you don't find funny. And because comedy really comes from your point of view, your worldview, and what, you know, what seems absurd to you and what seems serious and what seems worthy of mocking, I think it's actually much more revealing about who the person is in that way.
Blair Brown is my guest, and she stars in the TV series The Days and Nights of Molly Dodd. More after the short break. This is Fresh Air. Blair Brown is my guest, the star of the TV series The Days and Nights of Molly Dodd. Has television kept you away from having to worry about finding roles that you really wanted to play? You know, because you've had a steady gig.
Well, it's interesting, though, because the last 4 years I've worked with two writer-directors the whole time. I've worked with Jay Tarsis and with David Hare doing a play of his and a film of his. And now, you know, we finished sort of the end of the year, and I'm sort of out in the marketplace again, and there's, of course, the initial panic. But I found that it was very interesting to go and work with other people and have other people see you differently. And that the security and the joy that I'd found in the last few years of working in these worlds, it was actually time to leave and to move on to others. And I found I've started writing now, and I've sold a project to NBC for a possible series that I may or may not be in, but I would certainly be producing and creating with Rick Dresser, who was one of the main was the main writer for Molly Dodd this year. And I find it's very interesting now. I'm coming from, because of to work on a series is a very different experience for an actor, because you do know for an extended period of time where you're going to be. And when you're working with a group of people whose work you admire and who you just actually have a lot of laughs with on a daily basis, it's the reason you got into the business, not to do a television show, but to be with a group that's as creative as this. And I find now going back into the business in a different way, I'm just finding different groups, that there are a lot of people who want to work in the same way.
Well, Blair Brown, I think it's time to hear you sing.
when Sonny gets
blue. Before Molly Dodd, our listeners may remember you starred in Altered States and One Trick Pony. And one of your roles was in the Joseph Papp production of The Three Penny Opera.
That's right.
And I want to play from the cast recording of that.
Oh, God. Yeah, they're still available? They must be out of print by now.
Well, I've had mine a while. But this is you in the Jealousy duet.
Oh, shrieking away, yes. It's very high, this part.
It's very high.
Very high. It's the original scoring, you know? We were loyal. We were faithful.
Was it hard for you to go this high?
It didn't seem so. We'll hear, won't we? We'll find out.
Okay, here we go.
Come on out, you blossom of sorrow. Let us see your legs, my little sweetheart. I knew you have such a dainty ankle, but I'd love to see a more complete part. They tell me that Max is your behind is so
Brown, circa 1976. that's really high. Different from how I'm used to hearing you sing when you do your little songs on Molly Dodd.
It's true. It was odd with that show. I ended up playing Polly as well and Jenny for two nights. I ended up singing all the parts by default. It was very funny.
Were you going for a singing career or for a music theater career?
No, actually the reason I got the job is I'd worked with the musical director, Stanley Silverman, at the Guthrie. I had done a restoration play out there and The Crucible and Merchant of Venice out there, and Stanley knew that I could sing because I was terrified of singing auditions. And in fact, I went to this audition as a complete idiot. I didn't bring an accompanist, and I sang a cappella, and I started to sing, and I started way too high, and I couldn't get anywhere near. So I said, I have to start again, and I started off really low. Now, anybody else would have just said, thank you very much. But I had worked with Stanley for a couple of seasons at Stratford, Ontario, actually, and at the Guthrie Boat. So he said, no, she really can do this. So so we started, and afterwards I thought, well, I now I'll go up for musicals. But those auditions always terrified me. Acting auditions don't bother me in particular. But I was terrified by that. So that was the end of my musical career.
Blair Brown is my guest. She stars in the cable series The Days and Nights of Molly Dodd. More in 60 seconds. This is Fresh Air. Linda Wertheimer is with us. Linda, what's coming up on All Things Considered?
We have a number of stories looking at different aspects of the war and making war and covering the war and so on this afternoon, Terry. The diplomatic efforts that are going on even while the war is going on. We've been seeing a lot of articles about how terrible it is that parents are being sent to the Gulf. We're going to talk to some women who say, don't change that. It'll hurt the careers of women in the military. We've been listening avidly to reports from Baghdad, those reporters in Baghdad. We're going to hear from somebody who says there shouldn't be any reporters in Baghdad under those conditions. And we'll talk to the Red Cross working in Saudi Arabia.
Thanks, Linda. That and more on All Things Considered from National Public Radio. Actress Blair Brown is my guest. Your father was in the CIA.
Mm-hmm.
Did you ever know what he did when you were growing up?
Well, I knew he was with the agency. That's all I knew. And when I went to drama school years later, I went to a bilingual drama school in Montreal. That was sort of during the Vietnam War, the end of the Vietnam War. And I had to say that my father sold greenhouses. It was the only time that I'd been told that I couldn't say anything. In Washington, it was fine. I when I was a child, I had to say my father was with the State Department. And then by the mid-60s, at least in the States, and certainly into the 70s, then you could say he was with the CIA. And that was the first time I ever met any of my father's friends from the office, was in the sort of early 70s. He'd bring the agency, then moved out to Langley. It used to be in town, and we lived out in Virginia. And my father would bring friends home for lunch. And that was the first time I ever realized that my dad had never had office parties, that there'd never been any. I thought, oh, I didn't even realize the lack until then.
So during this period when you're supposed to say that your father sold greenhouses, mm-hmm. what an improbable job to come up with.
No, the curious thing was is that there was a whole other life at the agency. There were a lot of horticultural horticultural activity at the agency between orchid growers who had warm greenhouses and camellia growers who had cooler temperature greenhouses. And it also tended to divide up between Ivy League men and kind of state college men. It was a real class structure within the agency, which I know seems extremely bizarre. So my dad was a cold greenhouse camellia growing University of Pennsylvania CIA man. So it wasn't too much of a stretch, because in a pinch, he could tell you all about greenhouses.
But I don't get it. What were all the flowers for? What were they growing them for?
Just pleasure. Now, don't ask me why this group would single out flowers, but it was true of the agency at that time. I don't know if it still is.
When your father retired, did he tell you what he had been up to all those years, what kind of cases he was working on?
Well, it was interesting. His desk was Latin America, and he was just starting to write about some things because he was one of those unusual people that believed if you signed a piece of paper saying you wouldn't talk about something for 20 years, you actually wouldn't. And so he was just beginning to write about a lot of things, and then he died. So that was the end of that. And I found out that my mother actually got rid of all his old papers and all. So I don't know what he did, really.
Does it feel like a really big gap in your life to know?
Well, it does, and it's interesting because I'm not a very political person. I think some of it has to do with growing up in a family where a lot of times when I was political, I'd have arguments with my father. He'd say, well, you're wrong, and I can't tell you why, right? Which is unbelievably infuriating. So I tended not to have a lot of political opinions also because I knew that there was so much more information to be had about anything. If you were just a regular citizen reading the papers, there was a lot more information that was there that we didn't know, you know. What was the question again?
if it felt like a gap to not know what your father did.
It was very odd. It was very odd not to know. I mean, as a child, you take everything as a given. I thought that's how it was. But now in looking back, I do find it was very strange not to share in that part of a parent's life. I mean, my son is very involved in what I do and has a lot of opinions about what I do.
People magazine once described you as a debutante daughter. I was wondering if you were a debutante with a coming out party.
I was an actual debutante, yes, I was.
So you had a coming out party?
I did. I had a tea dance. Charming, huh?
did you want it, or was it forced on? Oh, wow.
No, I actually did. I was in a girls' school at the time, and that was the only possible way to meet boys, was to be a debutante. So it was that was the way to go. I lived out in the country, which sounds, you know, what lovely and pastoral, except it also means there are no people around. So I was very keen to be a debutante.
Did you later rebel against that life?
Absolutely. Scorned it, you know, now once I'd had the benefit of it, right? and it was easy to scorn it.
So how did you rebel?
Well, it was a different era. In those days, I took a lot of drugs, which is, you know, it's a different time now. Now you feel very cautionary about talking about it at this time in the world. Yes, I lived a fairly bohemian life. I had a child I never married. Nothing now that's of any consequence, but at the time they seemed fairly big deals.
What about acting? How did you start to do that? Was that what you were planning on doing when you were younger?
No, that was actually completely by default. I was in school, and I was miserable, and I wanted to take some time off, and that concept was something my parents couldn't wrap their minds around, which I understand now, being a parent. And so I had to find something to do. I thought, well, the alternatives are continuing in school, that was out, going into business, doing what, you know, I couldn't imagine, getting married, that was sort of anathema, and didn't see many likely candidates lined up. So it was really on a whim. I thought, theater school. Now, I had done the same number of plays that most people had, one or two things, and I wrote to all the schools in England for some unknown reason, and they had just had done their series of auditions. So I had a friend of mine's brother and sister-in-law were buskers, you know, those singers, street singers in London. And they got me a job on a program called Ready, Steady, Go, which was go-go dancers and singing to pop tunes in London. And so I told my parents, I'm going to England. I'm living with these buskers and I'll do this show. And my dad talked to some friends of his in the Canadian embassy. And before I knew it, and this is the only kind of aggressive thing like that he'd ever done in intervening in my life, there was a ticket and an audition to go to a theater school in Montreal that was bilingual, that was classical Michel Saint-Denis, the sort of Juilliard training, because there was no Juilliard for actors at that point. And I went up and I auditioned and fell in love with the city and got in and then went and thought, well, I'll do this for a bit until I figure out what I want to do.
So I have one last question for you. I should explain. You're in the New York bureau. I'm in Philadelphia.
That's it.
We're talking long distance. So I want to know if you wear your hair like Molly Dodd does or if you have a different hairdo.
No, the thing that's really good is that you can't see what I look like on radio. I didn't really go to a great deal of trouble to dress up for this. Pretty ratty looking. Molly is a much tidier person than I am. She also has a fleet of people keeping her that way at every moment.
Blair Brown, I want to thank you a lot for talking with us.
Oh, thank you.
Blair Brown stars in the Lifetime cable series The Days and Nights of Molly Dodd. Our interviews are produced by Phyllis Myers, Amy Sallet, and Pat Ford, with production assistance from Joan Tuohy and Roberta Shurrock. Naomi Person produces our reviews. I'm Terry Gross.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Additional support comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced, and from Talbots, retailers of women's classic clothing and accessories through stores and catalogs, 1-800-8-TALBOTS. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
On the next Fresh Air, the position of Jordan in the Gulf War. We talk with journalist Milton Viorst. I'm Terry Gross. I hope you'll join us for the next Fresh Air.